In her mid-20s, Sarah Centellis was at Harvard Divinity School, going through the ordination process to become a priest. And although she loved studying theology, loved preaching, she was realizing that her relationship with God, it just wasn't working out. She had to face up to the fact that God wasn't the one for her. But breaking up would mean overturning her whole life. But Sarah did finally call it quits with God. But even without him, she's kept reflecting on goodness, responsibility, and purpose. Her new book is called Draw Your Weapons, and in it, Sarah describes two significant friendships. One with a man who was a conscientious objector during World War II, and the other with a US soldier who was stationed at Abu Ghraib. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
You were reading the newspaper one day when you saw a photo of an elderly man that really struck you. Tell me about that photograph.
It was a photograph of this man. Like you said, he was an elderly man, and he was holding a violin, and he was glowing. Everything about him was filled with light, very luminous person. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but everything in my body said, you have to know this person. And I've never had that experience before when I was looking at the newspaper, and I decided I would find him. So I ended up calling information and asking for him. His name was Howard Scott.
What did it tell you in the newspaper story?
The newspaper actually had a lot of factual errors, which I didn't realize at the time, but it was his birthday. He was turning, I think, 82, and his grandson had completed a violin that Howard had begun 60 years earlier. And as his birthday present, he was gifting him the violin that he'd completed. And the newspaper story said that he'd been a conscientious objector during World War II and that he had been imprisoned because he protested the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And at that time, Bush was our president at that time, and I had been writing my dissertation about the torture photographs taken at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, and I was feeling very depressed. We'd protested war. There'd been the biggest marches around the world in, I think, history, and still we'd gone to war, and I was feeling hopeless. And so this person who had used his life to protest violence really spoke to me, and I wanted to find him, so I did.
And I guess that he was smiling in that photo must have seemed a kind of invitation, too.
Yes, and he was so delightful. When I called him, he said, oh, of course you can talk to me. Of course you can write
a book
about me.
So you just rang him randomly?
I did, and he answered the phone, and I told him that I wanted to write about him, and he said I could. But I could tell when I spoke with him that his mind wasn't completely right. So I said, well, let me just write you a letter so I can explain what I'd like to do, and I'll send you some of my books and we can talk. And I never heard from him. And I called and called the same number that I'd called before, and it would just ring. So I worried that maybe he'd died. But months later, I got a phone call from his daughter named Kayleen, who said she'd been going through her parents' things and she found my letter. And she said that months earlier, her mother had recently died, and she was trying to go through their things and put them in order, and she was overwhelmed by the task. So she'd said to the universe, I need someone to write a book about my parents. And she said that was May 25th, which is the same date that I wrote my letter. So she said, come see us. So I flew to meet their family and stayed in their home.
So where did they live? What part of America?
Well, Kayleen and her husband Paul live in Indianola, which is off the coast of Seattle on the west coast. And Howard at the time was living in Everett, and he was living in an assisted living facility at that time.
And when you first went to his daughter's home, what was it like?
It was magical, actually. It was so strange. As soon as we pulled up, they live in a small house, she and Paul. They right-sized, they called it. They moved out of a larger house into a smaller house, kind of in the woods on this island near the coast. And when I pulled up, it looked so familiar to me. And I'd actually had a meditation years before where I had meditated to myself as an older woman to try to get guidance for my life, and that my older woman self had told me to follow the writing, and she was sitting in this kind of A-frame studio in the woods in my imagination, and it looked exactly like Kayleen and Paul's house. So everything about it felt fairly like something bigger than us was orchestrating it.
What was your first meeting with Howard like?
I went to his home, and he was living in this facility that was not a great place to be. Kayleen wasn't pleased with it, and Howard wasn't either. It had kind of cement blocks. The walls were that way, and But he was so welcoming. He assumed I was one of his students. He'd been a professor for a long time, but he understood that I was there to try to help tell his story. And I remember the moment that Kayleen first put the violin in my lap. It was this bizarre experience of having seen something in a photograph, and then to have the real object sitting on my lap was so profoundly beautiful. And although Howard was losing his mind, he kept talking about what really mattered. So he would tell similar stories over and over again, but they were these profound stories about love, about the possibility of peace, about the importance of making a new world.
He told you a story about his father and how his father had died when he was a young man, that were swimming together.
Yes, and some of the details got confused, but I ended up doing some research to find out the correct ones. But his father was a swimming instructor, and they'd gone to the Sacramento River to swim, and there was a big current, and his father drowned. But everybody assumed that he was clowning around because he was kind of a jokester, and so no one helped him.
So his family were there watching.
Everybody was there. Howard was there. His sister was there. His sister went deaf after that and couldn't hear again. And for me, and Howard didn't say this, but he would say, the story started at that event. I asked him, tell me how your pacifism started, and he said it started when his father drowned. And it
in
always,
what way, do you think?
He didn't say, but in my mind, how I imagine it is that image of his father drowning and Howard doing nothing to stop it. He understood that when he would see people who were suffering, he had a responsibility to try to do something about it. And I think that's what motivated his anti-war activism and his protest of the internment of Japanese Americans.
So he was at university in New York in the 1930s, and this, of course, is the period when Hitler's coming to power, and it feels like the world is heading, you know, irreversibly towards war. What was Howard's attitude to this development in world politics in the 30s?
Well, he was actually in college in Washington State, which is on the West Coast, but he would go to New York to help people who were fleeing Hitler resettle in the United States. So he was helping people on the East Coast settle into apartments in New York City. And then on the West Coast, the internment of Japanese Americans began. So I think right away there was this disconnect in his mind. How can we be welcoming refugees on one side of the country and creating them on the other? And he was already protesting conscription, which is the draft that we had. He thought that drafts were unethical and that if people were supporting a war that a country was fighting, there would be no reason to force them to fight it. They would volunteer. So he was active. He and his wife, Ruane, were active protesting conscription, protesting war, and he had signed on to be a conscientious objector at that time. And when you were a conscientious objector, they would put you in work camps all over the country. And he was in one in California where he was fighting forest fires.
So that internment of him in a work camp, was that because he was drafted, or how did, what was the process?
He was
that?
Drafted twice, actually. He was drafted the first time, and you have to go in front of a draft board and say that you're opposed to the war, and he was supported by the Quakers to do that. And once you were declared a conscientious objector and the draft board agreed, then you'd be sent to a work camp to do work, what was called work of national importance. So he was fighting forest fires in California. And then he was, when the Japanese Americans started to be interned, he and Ruane decided that his protest wasn't protest enough, but he had to refuse to participate in the war in any way. So he walked out of the work camp and was imprisoned. And he was imprisoned.
So walked out, let them know that I'm not
leaving.
Going to participate mm-hmm. anymore. And what, I guess, was arrested somewhere?
He was arrested by the FBI, and he was put in prison. And he served several months term, and then he got out, and he and Ruane lived on a farm together, and she ended up becoming pregnant with their first child, and he was drafted again, which I didn't understand could happen. And he said, again, I will not fight and I will not go to the work camp. And that's when he was put in prison on McNeil Island, which is off the coast of Washington.
Are there any records that you found, or did he describe to you what the legal process was like? I mean, when he had to go to trial before a draft board, how was he treated?
He was treated like a felon by the prosecuting attorney. And he was very proud. One of the stories that he told over and over again was that the judge stood up for him. The judge said, this is not a criminal. This is a man of conscience, and you will not speak to him that way, and kind of cared for him, in that context. At the same time, the judge still sentenced him to prison, so it was maybe a symbolic kind of care, but he ended up serving 2 more years in prison and missed the birth of his daughter.
And how common was that for American men to refuse to fight as conscientious objectors in World War II?
It's much more common than any history I was taught. There is a huge, long tradition of resisting war from the very beginning of our country. And it's something that's, I think, hidden or not made public because it's kind of the mythology of you know, righteous war and service. But in my research, I found that as long as there's been war, there's been men and women refusing to fight.
You say that he was married recently and his wife had had a baby daughter while he was in prison. How did she feel about his refusal to go to war and his insistence on being imprisoned?
Well, it's interesting because I focused so much on Howard because Ruane had already died when I met Howard. But I think Ruane was really kind of the muscle behind what he was doing. She was very committed to the anti-war effort. She was doing all kinds of writing on her own in newspapers and public talks. And she kind of bore the brunt of his protest. She was ostracized in her communities. People struggled with the fact that her husband was in prison, and she had to manage to care for her family while her husband was locked away. So I think she was kind of the beating heart behind their decision to protest in that way.
Do you have the sense that they had a close marriage, a happy marriage?
Seems like they had one of the most magical marriages. That's another story that Howard would tell over and over. He told the story of when they decided to get married. It was when he was on leave from the work camp. He had gone to visit her, and they were paddling on this lake, which I think is such a beautiful image. And he said, I think we should get married. And they were, he said, we were skipping down the street, and they decided to get married the very next day and convinced the Methodist church to let them get married in the basement. And Kayleen told me that instead of throwing rice, people handed it to them because they said that they would need it. They knew that they were in the middle of this political activism and thought that they would need the support of uncooked rice.
The daughter that you met, that you became friends with, Kayleen, she told you that when she was at high school, she saw a film, a documentary about World War II, and in it there's footage of the Nazi death camps. And it seems that, to me, there are few wars as morally unambiguous as the Second World War. Like, if ever you're going to take up arms to fight, surely it should have been against Hitler. Did Howard's daughter resent or disagree with the pacifist stance that her dad took during the Second World War?
I think when she saw that film, which was from the Nuremberg trials, it was films actually showed to the defendants. I think it raised a lot of questions in her mind about what her father had done, his refusal to fight in that war. And she watched that film sitting next to a friend of hers named Ruth, who was Jewish, whose family had been killed, whose grandparents, I think, had been killed by the Nazis. So it was a question she really wrestled with, but she asked her father over and over again, how could you not fight? And he said, I think war is a sickness. And he had this idea that if you resisted violence with more violence, you were just creating a world with more and more and more violence, and that it had to be resisted in every situation. People had to be brave enough to say there's other ways to solve conflicts. And I think Kayleen deeply believes that he made the right decision, but it's she wonders if it did any good.
Mm. Does it make sense? Do pacifists talk about being a pacifist in some circumstances and not in others, or is it a kind of position that people embrace regardless of the scenario?
There's a range of kinds of pacifism, which I didn't understand that. I've always understood myself to be a pacifist, but I didn't realize people, when you say you're a pacifist, people would say, well, don't you believe in self-defense? If someone was attacking you, wouldn't you defend yourself? And for some pacifists, no, you wouldn't. I mean, there's people who, for example, will sweep ants out of the way so that they don't kill anything when they walk. But there's other people who understand that individual self-defense is a different situation than massive war, So in individual self-defense, you know you're making a decision to protect yourself and you know who you're protecting yourself against. Whereas in war, some pacifists argue, you don't know who you're killing. You could be killing innocent people. You could be killing people who are causing harm. You don't really know because the scale is so much larger. So there's a range of pacifist understandings. And I find that useful to think about. It's not as, it's morally ambiguous as well.
So Howard was imprisoned in two different prisons during World War II as a conscientious objector. What kind of work did he do in that second prison? How did he spend his time?
Well, this blew my mind because it's so different than how American prisons are now. But he had a lot of freedom. There was a dairy he worked. He had been a dairy farmer for a part of his life, and he was a dairy farmer in between the two imprisonments. And at this farm, they had a dairy, so he volunteered to work in the dairy, and he would be allowed to kind of wander this island. And then when he was walking to go work with the cows or whatever he was doing in the dairy, and on one of those walks, he came across an abandoned building. When he looked inside, he realized it used to be a wood shop. And he got in trouble for going inside this abandoned building, but he was so convincing. I think everybody must have loved him at this prison. He was so convincing to the guards that they allowed him to transform this abandoned building into a wood shop, and then the prisoners could make things there. And while Howard was working in that wood shop, he met this man who was building a violin, and Howard became kind of obsessed with this idea of making an instrument and decided he would want to make one too. So he asked the other prisoner if he would help him learn how to do this work. And the prisoner agreed, but the prisoner, who I think was there for possibly for murder, but I'm not sure, he was released before Howard was, before he'd completed the instrument. So then he had to learn on his own. And
how did he know how to do that?
It was crazy. He asked his wife, Ruane, to find a book on violin making in the library, and she did. And then she would type up the instructions, and I got to see these letters that she wrote because she was limited by the number of pages she could write and the number of letters she could write per week. And in these, she would jam as many typewritten pages as she could on a page, and it would give directions for violin building. He had none of the right equipment, so he had to make his own equipment. And in between telling him how to build a bridge, for example, she would write about their daughter's first steps or whether she was losing teeth. They're these beautiful directions with these loving drawings. And so he taught himself how to build a violin with these instructions that Ruane sent.
And did he manage to finish it while he was in prison?
He did not. He had all the pieces to it, but it was not completed. And when he got home, he kind of put it in the back of his closet in a box. And it wasn't until many decades later that he showed his grandson, whose name is Noel, he showed him the pieces of the violin because Noel was a furniture maker, was in school on the East Coast of the United States learning how to make furniture. And he just showed it to Noel and then put it back away. And later, when Noel was in school, one of his friends, who happened to be a violin maker, asked if he would be willing to build her some furniture, I think a bedside table. And she said, as a joke, if you need a violin to be made, let me know. And Noel remembered the pieces of the violin in the back of his grandfather's closet. And he said, well, actually, I do have a violin that you could complete. Her name is Jess Fox. And so she and Noel worked together to complete it. And that was the finished violin that I saw in that first photograph.
Did Howard know that they were working on it for him?
No, he did not. And it had never been played. And he hadn't really thought much about the violin. But as soon as he saw it, he knew that that's what they were gifting him with.
What an amazing present. And could someone play it? Did he know how to play the violin?
He never learned how to play the violin, but Jess Fox did, so she played the violin at his birthday.
You became obviously really close with Howard and with the rest of his family. When did he pass away?
He passed away, I think, 3 years ago. I might have the dates a little bit wrong because his birthday is tomorrow, and I just still feel his presence in my life, and I'm still close with his daughter. And I feel like his light continues, and his voice continues, and his protest continues, even though he's died.
The story of Howard and Howard's refusal to fight is one kind of response to war that you investigate. And then there's a really different story as well that you tell in Draw Your Weapon, Sarah. I want to start with the photos from Abu Ghraib that you say you were writing on, that you were studying. Do you remember when you first saw those as a citizen and what your response was?
I'll never forget when I saw those first images. The first image I saw was the iconic photograph of the man, the hooded man standing on the box. And it spoke to me in a way that photographs have not ever spoken to me. It was in 2004, which was 2 years before I saw that photograph of Howard with the violin. And at the time, I was a doctoral student in theology, and I was writing a dissertation on imagination, the importance of being able to imagine another world in order to bring that world into being. But when those photographs came out, people were calling them crucifixion images. And as a theologian and as a person who had almost been ordained as a priest, I wanted to understand what that narrative of Christian violence was doing around these photographs. What did it mean to put a narrative of salvific violence, like Jesus was killed to save the rest of us, onto the bodies of tortured Muslim men? Would that make people protest torture, or would that make people think torture is something that we need to do to keep us safe, and the us being Americans? So I changed my dissertation topic and decided to write about those photographs.
And you also taught it to students. Why? What were you wanting to have them think about with those images?
I wanted, I've changed how I teach. When I first started teaching, I was teaching a lot of courses on photography and the ethics of looking at violence. And I wanted my students to see as many violent images as possible.
That would have been a great class, Sarah.
They were like, oh, great, this is so fun.
might just go to the refect instead, I think, today.
Yeah. I wanted them to know what was going on in the world. And I thought that we had an ethical obligation to look at images like that. But then the more I started reading, the more I started to doubt that position, and I thought, I didn't know what good our looking did.
It's such an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I remember that with the Abu Ghraib photos, or with, you know, terrible photos of ISIS beheadings. You know, those images are there, and I think all of us struggle with this. Are we condoning it or somehow participating by watching, or are we being cowards if we don't watch? I mean, what do you think about? Do we have a moral obligation to look at those sorts of images?
For a while, I thought maybe we were participating in the violence by looking, and I wondered if we were further violating the subjects of those kinds of photographs. Recently, I read a book called The Civil Contract of Photography by Ariella Azoulay, and she made an argument that made me rethink everything I'd been thinking for about 10 years. And she said when photographs of violence are taken, the subjects of those images imagine a future viewer who will look at the images and turn whatever happened to them into a state of emergency, or have a sense of urgency to respond and to stop that kind of violence happening, and that's the only reason they allow themselves to be photographed. And so you can ask whether they're actually allowing themselves to be photographed. But when I imagine a person in a photograph, imagining me in the future looking at them and doing something about the violence they've experienced, it seems to me then that I definitely have an ethical obligation to look, and not just to look, but to act.
When you were teaching those photographs or discussing the photos from Abu Ghraib at your university you were working at in California, a student called Miles was in your class. And what did you discover was his connection?
Miles had actually been stationed at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq as a prison guard. And that was such a profound and life-changing encounter for me. I had been studying those images for several years at that point, and it was almost like having like a TV character walk out of the TV into my classroom, except that it had never been a television show. It had always been real. And he really challenged my own pacifism, because he'd only gone to war to earn money to be able to go to college to sit in my classroom. So it made me realize, although I'd use pacifism to kind of let me off the hook, to think because I was philosophically against the wars my country was fighting, I thought they had nothing to do with me. But if I had students who were fighting in order to be able to afford to sit in my classroom, it seemed I needed to ask more difficult questions than that.
What kind of response did he have to you showing the photographs? He wasn't actually there in the prison while that torture was happening. He was stationed there, I think, two secondments afterwards. Yes. But how did he feel about it? Was he angry at you? Was he ashamed?
No, it's so strange. We're still friends. And I asked him, do you remember when I showed those photographs what you thought? And he said he doesn't remember. And I don't remember. I think I showed them before I knew that he had been stationed there. He has PTSD, and so everything that he shared with me during those years was pretty flat. His affect was very flat and descriptive. even when he would be telling me horrific things that he'd witnessed. So I think there was a way in that period of his life that he was very shut down around those events, but he understood, because I was engaging those images, that I would be open to hearing from him. I think he worried at first that I was anti-soldier or anti-American, and it was only in our conversations where he grew to trust me and to understand that I was open to listening about his experience.
Had he been able to speak to many people about his experience in the army in Iraq?
He'd been back for 2 years when I met him, and he said I was the first person who ever asked him about his experience at war.
Why is that?
I think that we have a way in the United States of demonstrating kind of a pseudo-engagement with our veterans. I think we thank them for their service, which for many veterans is such a strange thing to be thanked for, especially if they've been engaged in complicated activities, and war is ethically complicated. That's what it is. I think it's a way, if we don't ask them about what they experienced, we don't have to face the fact that we send people to do terrible things, whether you understand that to be ethically justified or not. So I think people don't know what to say to soldiers, and so they say nothing, or they say kind of empty stock phrases instead of actually engaging them about their experience.
Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
Tell me, where did you do most of your growing up?
I did most of my growing up in Texas, in a town called Dallas.
And what were your family doing there?
My dad was a lawyer, and my mom had been a journalist, and then had four children. They had four children. I'm the oldest of four. And I moved from New York City, and I moved when I was in first grade, and I kind of imagined this wild, wild west landscape of cows. I asked my dad how I was going to get to school, would I have to ride a cow? And he was like, no, it's a major metropolitan area. But that's where I spent most of my childhood.
What was that move like for your parents, do you think? I imagine it's a very different part of America.
Yeah, my father had grown up in New Orleans in Louisiana, and he'd spent high school in Dallas, so he was kind of coming home. His parents lived there. But for my mom, who had been either on the East Coast or in the Midwest, the South was kind of a shock for her.
And what did it mean for her career? She'd been a journalist.
I think once there were four children, she decided that she would need to focus on us, and I think that was something she continued to wrestle with for a long time.
Your family were religious, were Catholic. Tell me about the significance of religion in your day-to-day life as a kid when you were growing up.
I did grow up Catholic. We went to church every Sunday. But I also grew up with a very critical orientation toward religion, even as we were faithful as a family. My dad grew up Catholic also, and my mother grew up Episcopalian, and she converted to Catholicism when she and my father married. So I would sit in church, and my mom would kind of whisper things to me like, there's another way to see this. I understood that these were, you know, stories that we told, and there were different ways to tell them. I also was quite precocious and asked a lot of questions that the priests at church weren't too keen to answer.
What sort of questions did the young Sarah ask the priest?
The family lore is that I told my dad I had a question to ask the priest, and he brought me there, and I asked, is suicide a sin? And I was 6 years old at the time, and the priest said yes. And then I said, did Jesus go willingly to his death? And he said, yes. I said, well, then did Jesus commit suicide? And my dad was very proud. The priest kind of just shook his head. I don't remember him answering in any way that satisfied my six-year-old self.
What kind of sense of God did you have from that church? Who was it that was in your mind or in your heart when you were praying? What was he like?
I had a very kind of schizophrenic understanding of God. I had this one version of God that loved me before I was born, that knew me, that stitched me in my mother's womb, that kind of like all benevolent, all loving kind of parental figure. And then there was another very scary version of God, a God who watches you and judges you, a God willing to kill his own son, a God who punishes sinners. So I was quite confused by the different versions of God that were presented to me.
Do you think that had an effect on your own sort of sense of self or confidence or anxiety as you were a teenager? Did you know, I don't know if it's chicken or the egg, but did you start to have that kind of division within yourself about, am I worthy or not worthy, good or bad?
Yes, I spent a lot of time feeling unworthy. I mean, we talk a lot now about kids having to grow up in social media and always performing and putting their own lives, creating a sense of themselves that they can put online. And I was kind of doing that before. We didn't have computers. You
know? God is the ultimate Instagram. Yes. Everything is being watched all the time.
It's watched and liked or not liked. And the punishment is high. You know, the risks are high if you misstep. So that sense of being watched and living my life for somebody else really plagued me for a lot of my life.
You went away to college. Was religion a part of your life when you were independent then from your family for the first time?
Not at all. I didn't go to church at all when I went to college. I really found the faith of books. I studied literature and art history and became interested in the stories that human beings tell.
And what job did you get, Sarah, first off, after finishing your first
degree? I was an elementary school teacher in Compton, California.
So tell me about Compton. It's a name that I've kind of heard in rap songs. Yes. or in movies. What's it like?
Well, it's a beautiful community made up of amazing families, and it's tremendously under-resourced. And this was in 1995. I was 21 years old. I did a program called Teach for America, which takes underprepared college students from elite universities and sends them to school districts that need the best teachers, but they're really sending people who have no idea what they're doing and have no idea how to teach.
So the idea is because you're smart, you've gone to a good school, you'll be able to really help these kids, mm-hmm. but you didn't feel
no.
prepared.
I think it's a very colonial model to take outsiders who you think are somehow have something to offer to these communities when the communities already know what they need, and they need not a revolving door of teachers, they need people committed to education. So I showed up at 21, no sense of myself as a white woman, no sense of like critical race theory or structural racism. I had a classroom of 30.
Probably didn't know how to use a photocopier at 21.
I was good at photocopying my face. But I had 36 students, and we didn't have any books in our classroom.
Didn't have any books?
Nope. Ceiling tiles were falling off the ceiling. I had mice and maggots crawling through the floor. The playground had no equipment. So it was this profound awakening for me of understanding that the system had been designed to help me, even though the stories I'd been told was that I'm smarter than everyone, I'm better, I deserve what I got. But really, it was because my family had money and I could. The system was meant to work for me. And then I had this classroom filled with brilliant students, and it was doing the opposite for them.
Was it a violent place to live? Were you scared?
I wasn't scared. I didn't live in Compton, but I wasn't scared. It was in the 90s, and there was a lot of gun violence, a lot of gang violence, but I never felt afraid. I felt very welcomed by the community.
Were you going to church at this point in your life when you traveled and living in this really tough professional situation in LA?
At first, I was not going to church, but my mother came to visit me, and she could kind of see that my identity had been shattered. I was trying to figure out, okay, now that I have a better understanding of structural racism and oppression, how am I going to live in the world? And I took her to see a play, and I remember we were driving on the LA freeways, and on the side of the road was a dead body, and she was like, oh my God, we have to do something to give you some kind of support here. And she had heard on the radio about this church called All Saints in Pasadena. She actually had the name of the church wrong, but we ended up driving on a Sunday to Pasadena looking for this mysterious church.
How far is that from where you were living?
I was living at the time, I think I was living in Hollywood, and it's pretty much of, it's a pretty big drive. But we ended up finding this church, and it was the most incredible place I'd ever been. It was justice-oriented and engaged and filled with people and dedicated to helping to bring into being a better world. So
this wasn't a Catholic church. This was an Episcopalian church.
It was an Episcopalian
church. Which is what the tradition your mum had been
yes.
raised in.
Yes.
And what are the kind? What was the experience of it that was different from the Catholic church that you'd been raised in? How is it different?
Well, this particular church is very progressive. So they'd been doing, for example, same-sex marriages for decades at this point. They have women priests. That's a huge difference from Catholicism. So it was just socially progressive and justice-oriented.
You were at this point in your life, in your early 20s, Sarah, involved in some fairly dodgy relationships. Did the God that you were discovering at All Saints feel like a much better bed, a much sort of safer or more meaningful kind of relationship to have almost?
It did. It did feel like a good relationship to have. I mean, I think back to that time, I was in my early 20s and I was going to church like five times a week. If I met myself now, I would be kind of freaked out by that person. But I found such a sense of community and of purpose and this idea that God was on the side of the oppressed. And that really spoke to me at that time.
And it structured your whole social life if you're going that regularly as well, I guess.
It did. I mean, in your 20s, you have all kinds of time. So I managed to have a vibrant social life. But yeah, a lot of my friends were from church.
So you had been teaching. It doesn't sound like you were feeling that you were really making the difference or being able to help the way that you wanted to as a teacher. What did you start thinking that God was wanting you to do with your life?
I decided that churches could be places that could fight the kind of racism and injustice that I'd seen in Compton, California. You know, that in California puts Beverly Hills, this super rich community in the same area as Compton, right next to each other. And I thought, because of my experience at All Saints, that churches could offer some kind of remedy for that. And so I decided that I wanted to become a priest.
What kind of reaction did you get from your family or friends when you announced you were going to become a priest?
I don't think they were surprised. It's funny because now that I've left the church, my parents weren't surprised by that either. I think they had a sense that organized religion was going to be a little bit too small for me, that I was going to have to leave parts of myself outside of the church if I wanted to participate fully in that. And I think they knew before I did that it wasn't going to work, but they were completely supportive of me deciding to take that path.
And what did it entail? How do you start to become a priest? What did you have to do?
Well, I applied to divinity school, and I ended up going to Harvard Divinity School, which is not a seminary. So seminaries are places where you go for one particular religious tradition. In Harvard Divinity School, they have everybody from atheists to Buddhists to Muslims to Christians to Orthodox. To Judaism. There's all different kinds of religious and non-religious traditions. And there are people there who just are trying to study religion. And then there are people who want to be practitioners of faith. So right away, I was exposed to tremendous variety, different ways to think about God. And I really fell in love with theology, which is this what my teacher, Gordon Kaufman, calls the study of the gods human makes, the gods humans make and their effects in the world. And so I really fell in love with that kind of academic work.
And how did that change your idea of God? I mean, from what you're saying, it had already gone through some transformations from when you were a kid and you had this God who you felt both loved you and was judging you, to the God involved in social justice that you encountered in the church in Pasadena. And then you're studying God again in this context of a theological situation. How did that change this idea of who God was?
Well, I stopped going to church at that time.
Wait a minute.
A red flag.
So you're studying to be a priest, you're going to Harvard Divinity School, and you stopped going to church.
Yes, I stopped going to church.
What was going on?
I couldn't find a place that felt like home to me. I went to the kind of weekly chapel service that the school offered, but I didn't go to church on Sundays. I really found God in books that I was reading and couldn't find a spiritual home.
So did that make you wonder whether you were doing the right thing with your life? Did you think that the problem was you or the problem was the situation? How are you squaring those two things
together? I think I was in some level of deep denial because I would tell people I'm going to be a priest, but I wasn't associated with any church, and you have to be part of a church in order to get ordained. But I felt like the thinking that I was doing felt religious to me, so I just kind of kept ignoring that major problem that I had.
Did any of your teachers or other people in the community kind of raise this with you?
No, nobody did, really. I mean, once I graduated, it's a three-year it's a Master's of Divinity. It's a three-year program. And once I graduated and realized, I prepared to be a priest, but I don't have a church, I realized then it was a problem. So I got a job at a church in a suburb of Boston, and I worked directing the children's education program and entered the ordination process there. But I knew kind of from the beginning that it wasn't going to work.
What was it that was against what you were feeling? What was the, what were the signals in that process that this wasn't right?
It was just after 9/11. It was in 2001. And basically the entire United States was taking a turn towards conservatism in the wake of that violence. And the church was having arguments about things that I was already past in my life. They were arguing about same-sex marriage. They were arguing about whether women should be ordained. They were arguing about all these social issues that I didn't want to spend my time on. I wanted to spend my time creating a more just world. I didn't want to spend my time arguing about these moral imperatives that, for me, there weren't two sides of those arguments. So I kind of had a dual breakup. One was I experienced a lot of sexism in that church, a lot of kind of harassment about being a woman who was in a position of power, even though the head of that church was also a woman. So at first, the story I told myself was that I couldn't be there because it was too sexist. But really, at the same time, I was recognizing that I also didn't believe in the version of God that I was going to have to believe in order to be part of that church. My mind just wouldn't do what it was being asked to do. But that came much later and had a lot more grief associated with it.
Well, grief, it must have been a hugely emotionally difficult decision. It's not something like a long marriage, I guess. It's not something you can just walk away from.
No, I imagine my insides almost like these canyons that are formed by water. I remember visiting canyons in Utah and realizing it used to be an ocean, and now it's a desert, but these canyon walls remain that were formed by water. And I thought, oh, that's what my mind looks like, but Christianity was the water, and now I have these walls of a canyon left behind, and I have to figure out how I want to give my own life meaning. What does it mean to lose the stories that we tell ourselves about what it means to be a human? And I also missed that version of God that loved me and was watching me. Even though it sometimes scared me, I had found comfort in that story.
I mean, did the universe feel a kind of lonely place when you were making that break?
It did at first. And I remember people saying to me, well, don't you miss the sense of something bigger than you, when they would find out I no longer considered myself a Christian. And I started answering, well, have you been outside? Like, look at the stars. We are very small and everything is bigger than us. And I've found now much comfort from the natural world.
Was there a moment, though, Sarah, that you had to face up and say to yourself, this isn't working, this plan I had for my life is over? Do you remember when you first had to tell the people that you were studying with that you weren't going to continue?
I remember exactly the moment. I'd already finished my master's, and I was in the doctoral program in theology, and I was in the ordination process. And there's a committee that is called a discernment committee that gets together to see if they think that you are actually called by God to become a priest. And I casually mentioned to them that I was moving in with my boyfriend like the next weekend, and they got very upset and they started saying things like they didn't want me to be around their kids. They wouldn't want their kids to know that I was living outside of marriage with a man. And I knew then that it was over. And I remember sitting in my car in the parking lot and crying and calling my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, and telling him it's over. And it almost makes me cry to think about it now. It was this moment where I knew that I couldn't go back.
What did the future look like for you when you were sitting in the car, having just made that decision?
Well, it's hard to have trained for so long for something and then to turn away from it. So it looked both very open and very frightening. I think it was at that moment that I decided, okay, well, I want to learn as much as possible about theology. If I've left this world, I want to know more about it than the people who didn't welcome me into it. But I had no idea what I would do for work. I didn't know who I was in the world. What did it mean to be a religious scholar and to not be religious? There were all kinds of questions that I was confronting at that time.
And what were the first steps that you took then into your new life?
I did a lot of writing. I interviewed a bunch of women about their experience in churches all over the country to see if they'd had similar experiences. I kind of took an intellectual approach. Okay, I'll write a book and see if I'm alone in this or if this is kind of systemic. And I studied. I enrolled in the doctoral program and started studying.
And when you ask now, Sarah, if you believe in God or if you're a Christian, what do you answer?
I usually say I'm agnostic, and I think of my professor, Gordon, who I talked about earlier, who said that the question about whether God exists isn't a question humans can answer, and it's not the right question. He said that the word God is out in the world doing all kinds of work, and it's our job to figure out what kind of work those gods are doing and to invent better gods who can create a more just and life-giving world for all of us.
Do you think then that the kind of writing and research and relationships that you formed, and like you describe in Draw Your Weapons with Miles and with Howard, is that a way of continuing the sort of the heart of what you were doing at Divinity School?
Yeah, I think most people go to church because they want community and they want closeness and they want a sense of purpose and they want to know that they're doing their part to make a world that's better for people. And I find that in my relationships with people. I find it in a community. I'm in a community now that's feminist and earth-based and activist. So I think I do find meaning in relationship, whether that's relationship with the environment or relationship with friends or activism I'm doing in my community now to support immigrants. I think it's no different than what I would have hoped to find in a church, but it's happening outside those walls.
Sarah Sintelas, thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you, Sarah. It was such a delight to talk with you.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski on ABC Radio.
My guest on Conversations today was Sarah Sintelas. Her book is called Draw Your Weapons. Her earlier book about her ending her relationship with God is called Breaking Up with God. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.